Welcome to the Bumblecast. I am your host, Ian the Bumble King Flynn, and joining me as always is that remix master, DJ Kyle Krause.
Wiki wiki. That was terrible. That was awful. I apologize.
You have nothing to apologize for. That was amazing.
I couldn't think of anything else. You kind of thrust me into the DJ role, and I was like, well, what do DJs do?
They go wiki wiki on the little wiki wiki board. That's the official term, right?
That's exactly what it's called.
You have to pronounce it that way. Wiki wiki.
Yeah, that's precisely what you call it.
Long-time listeners of the show, you know, all 12 previous episodes, you may notice that things were a little different at the start. That's right, we have new remixed versions of the intro.
Oh, yeah, provided by my good buddy, Carbohydro M. Long-time watchers of Extra Credits might recognize that name, because they use one of his remixes for the theme song, for Extra Credits. So he's been in the video game music remix scene for a long time, and is just a really awesome rockin' dude. So huge thanks to Christoph for helping us out with an awesome new theme song.
And keep your ears peeled, because there will be more in the future.
yes.
Last time, we discussed video game music at length.
Right.
You know, what was good, what was bad, how it accentuates a game, and how it really can affect the entire experience. But there's more to game music than just listening to it as it's presented in its original form. Today, on the show, we have an expert, Dr. Kylian Kroskinsk, who is an expert in the remixing video game field. I am suddenly slipping into David Attenborough. Why am I slipping into David Attenborough?
I would not call myself necessarily an expert, an aficionado, maybe?
Well, you can pronounce that. I can't, so we'll go with that.
A historian? Maybe, kind of? I don't know if I'm really a historian on this, necessarily.
Gets you closer to wearing a monocle and looking professional.
I wasn't there for the earliest days of video game music arrangements, but I had a lot of help in researching the topic, and it goes pretty deep, and this episode is going to be all about the history of video game music arrangements and remixes, and sort of where we've come, because it's kind of a big deal. I don't think a lot of people necessarily realize or think about video game music arrangements and how they've sort of affected the video game industry as a whole, but they have actually had a major impact. For example, a lot of the people who started out doing stuff at Overclocked Remix or VG Mix or any of those other websites, a number of them have now gone on to become composers for both indie games and major releases. Some of them you may have heard of, like Soul Calibur 5. That is a very big, very big game series.
That's the one with the swords and the stabatize each other lots.
Right.
Yeah. But it used to be, then they started throwing in Jedi and other silly things.
Ah, they took that out of Soul Calibur 5.
Oh, they did? They went back to basics?
Well, kind of. They're still magic users, but there's no, you know, Jedi or anything.
Okay.
The Star Wars thing was only for Soul Calibur 4.
I mean, I was all hyped when Link was in there, and they did an amazing job with him, but then it's like, and now there's Vader and Yoda, and it's like, Link makes sense. He's got melee weapons out the wazoo. Lightsaber, you land one hit, the fight's done.
Yeah.
Because you're in half.
Yeah, Soul Calibur has fun, though, with the crossover stuff. I'm okay with it. But anyway, this isn't about video game crossovers. This is about video game music. Video game music remixes and arrangements trace their roots all the way back, as far as I can tell, to 1982. during the height of the arcade craze. Now keep in mind, most arcade games had music that was like no more than 5 seconds long. So they were just little jingles, and yet there were still a couple of albums released arranging specifically Namco arcade games. Like Pac-Man's obviously the most famous one, but Galaxian and games like that. So back in 1982 in Japan, famous Japanese keyboardist and electronic music composer Koji Ueno originally arranged a 1982 album called Video Game Music. And that was sort of the genesis of the Arrange album in Japan.
Now, by arrange, do you mean like full orchestral or?
Not necessarily. Usually it was just maybe straight covers of the little short jingles that were then turned into medleys, or basically full electric, kind of jazzy arrangements, I suppose.
Were these done with live instruments, or were these still digital compositions?
These were generally done with live instruments using actual, like, keyboards and guitars and stuff like that. But
I'm just having a hard time imagining the Pac-Man theme to live instruments at all. Like, maybe to a kazoo, but, you know.
It can work.
Strings?
It can work. I've heard it.
Trumpets?
Yeah. I don't think these were orchestral at the time.
No, I don't mean anything.
Yeah, I know what you mean. These were released on Yen Records, which was a subsidiary of Alpha Records in Japan. And that led to the creation of what might very well be the very first video game music label called the GMO, or the Game Music Organization. And that was in 1985.
That makes everyone who says they don't trust GMOs sound really silly.
Yeah. This is true. GMO had a very different meaning in Japan in 1985. As we go through the 80s, house bands for developers were very popular. We had Capcom's Alf Lira, depending on how you want to romanize it. And that was consisting of a couple different members, mainly Yoko Shimomura on keyboards, who's most well known nowadays for the Kingdom Hearts soundtrack and the soundtrack for Street Fighter II. We also had Sega's house band, the SST band, or the Sega Sound Team band, who I love. They're fantastic. And Nihon Falcom's JDK band, which was Falcom was the E's series, YS. They were the developers of that series. So they had their own house band as well. And there were some others too. I couldn't really dig up any more names, but I know there were others out there. I want to say that Nintendo even had one. The Akihabara Electric Sound Team, I believe, was Nintendo's. And it was a really cool thing. And unfortunately, the house band concept has become kind of rare, but there's definitely still official Arrange albums coming out all the time. The Japanese developers really love doing arrangement albums for their games. Persona, the Persona series especially right now seems to be especially common with them, so they're out there. Mega Man is still getting them. In fact, that's the only recognition Mega Man is getting, is new arrangement albums from Capcom.
It's something.
Yeah, it's something. Very small, but it's something. So that's sort of the state of official arrangements from developers and publishers. Now, on the fan side, things get a bit murkier. The fan side is a very, very different beast. The internet led to the formation of the demo scene, and this was around 1986, back when you still had to dial directly into bulletin boards with a modem. Like, the World Wide Web as we knew it did not exist.
Back in 86, could you get anything higher than 12K?
Probably not. It probably took all day to download, like, 500 kilobyte file. Or
and
maybe even several days.
And people were that dedicated into uploading remixes of songs, which probably couldn't have been much more than chiptunes at this point.
Right, they weren't even remixes at this point. It was original stuff.
Can you even imagine trying to move an MP3 at that kind of data speed?
No. Because it wouldn't be possible. Well, it would be possible, but you'd be waiting probably several weeks for it to download.
I've been in this chair since January. I've almost downloaded Guilty Sparks. I almost... What do you mean connection error? Corrupted file?
No!
no! Anyway, the demo scene. We have to talk about this because it's where kind of where everything started for fan-made arrangements. The demo scene was spun off of the software piracy cracking scene. Mostly the video game piracy scene, actually.
So remixes came from old internet sea shanties.
Kind of, yes.
Arr.
Yes, there's actually... video game remixes have their roots kind of in two different piracy scenes. It's kind of weird how that happened. I'll be getting to how it ties into video game emulation later. But for those who aren't aware, which might be most of you, the demo scene began as a spin-off of the illegal game-cracking and piracy groups that were around in the mid-80s. Basically, what those groups would do is they would sort of create these little demos that when you first opened a game, when you first booted up a game, it would play like a music and sound visualizer and kind of be their signature, the group's signature for cracking the game. They were very proud of this stuff. These guys were true programmers. They knew their way around the computers at the time, getting around the copyright protection on all that stuff. And they
was
were
it really that intrinsic in the 80s, though?
And that, well, yeah, it could be. And they were proud of it. So they showed it off, and they showed off what they were able to do with the system by creating these demos that were just these audiovisual, basically videos that just kind of was like, yeah, we did this. We created this. Look at what we did. And from there, those demos got more impressive, and they got to a lot more more of a following than the game cracking scene did. So it kind of spun off into the demo scene, and that's sort of where the whole thing started. A lot of computers at the time, like the Atari ST, actually had inputs for MIDI, so you could hook up a keyboard to them, like a piano-style keyboard, and create music using the computer itself directly and using the hardware. So that's what they did. So it was the Commodore 64, the Commodore Amiga, the Atari ST, and the ZX Spectrum, or ZX Spectrum, depending on what you prefer. I think it should be the ZX Spectrum because it's a British computer, but I'm American, so...
The debate of whether to say Z or Z is a whole show in and of itself.
Right, right.
The correct answer is Z, of course, but we'll save that for a later time.
We could definitely talk about that, yes. So, as the demo scene carried on, there were two things that sort of came out of it. With the rise of the World Wide Web, we saw the Commodore computer remix community arise from that, coming out of there in like the mid-90s, roughly, with C64Audio.com being one of the first websites to have video game music remixes hosted by people who were either using the original hardware to do their remixes or were using trackers, which are still used today for a lot of chiptune stuff, and kind of led to the rise of the modern chiptune scene. So, once C64Audio sort of came on board, there was also, in 1996, the rise of VGMusic.com, which you might be aware of, Ian.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, VGMusic.com was one of my favorite websites at the time, because you could find all sorts of different MIDIs of video game music there. And these were all hand-transcribed by a small community of fans of video game music. And they started kind of doing arrangements and messing around with the MIDIs. So that was sort of where another part of the remix community was starting to grow. As we go on a little bit further down into 1999. We get to rpgamer.com, roleplayinggamer.com. And they hosted the X-MIDI remix competitions in 1999, and these were before OCR. A few of the folks who competed in those compos are still actively making music, which was kind of surprising to me when I went back to go look through them. I'm like, holy crap, I recognize that name. Holy crap, this person's actually working in the game music industry. Once we saw the X-MIDI compos, during that time in the late 90s, there was also cover bands. Cover bands were becoming popular, a little bit popular. There was still only a few, but they were definitely around. Press Play on Tape might have been one of the first ones. They came out of the Commodore 64 arrangement scene. A band called Generic, who later became The Advantage, and the Genova Project, who were a Final Fantasy VI cover band who became the Mini Bosses. And we'll come back to them. Yeah, we'll come back to them later because they play a pretty important part in where we are today.
Also amazing music, but
we'll get to that. Yeah, all those bands are definitely ones you should check out. Press play on tape. Still around and still great. Man, they've been around for forever. Video game music remix chat rooms were also pretty, I wouldn't say common. They weren't common. There were a few. It's very small groups. A lot of them, at least some of the members of a chat room on IRC called SS Tracks, went on to VG Mix, which we'll talk about in a little bit here. They were basically running their own competitions or compos in making game remixes at the time. I think some of these were MIDI based. It was starting to get to a point where software was catching up and MP3s were sort of becoming a thing. So that's sort of where it stands at the time. And then at the end of 1999, things kind of changed a bit.
That's when Y2K happened and everything shut down.
Almost.
We went back to hunting primal beasts out in the fields.
Almost.
And the Monday somebody said the bug didn't happen and we went back to our regular lives.
Almost. Nope, actually it was December of 1999 when a website that I'm sure many of our listeners have at least heard of, called Overclocked Remix, launched. Now, OCR was originally a spinoff of Overclocked.org, and Overclocked.org was an information hub for game console emulation. The site founder, DJ Pretzel, aka David Lloyd, it was basically like an emulation fan site and a webcomic, and he decided, inspired by sites like C64 Audio, to go ahead and create sort of a collection and a repository of video game music remixes that weren't necessarily dedicated to just the Commodore 64 or just the Amiga or things like that.
That madman.
I know, he's crazy. It's insane. So he didn't invent remixes, but I give OCR credit for helping to kind of popularize them today. It's definitely an influence there. So, but from there, from 1999 to 2002, things carried on a little bit. There were a ton of submissions to OCR, and DJP had a hard time keeping up with them, so he instated the dreaded judges panel.
Bom, bom, bom.
Yes, the judges panel, the source of much ire, at least at the time. Not so much these days, I suppose. I don't hear too many, at least public complaints about the OCR judges panel anymore, but at the time, it was kind of a big deal, and that's what led to the Great Remixer Exodus of 2002. So some of the OCR had a forum, and it was a pretty active forum, definitely a good community building up there. 2001 was about when I discovered OCR, but I didn't know the forums existed until about 2002, and unfortunately, I completely missed this. I never saw it. Things were getting pretty heated at the time. There was a remix posted that some of the other remixers on the site didn't really care for. And so there were arguments on the forums. Things got really heated and people started getting banned. And those people decided to leave. And they created their own video game music remix website with Blackjack and that other thing.
See, I was going to go there and thought, eh, maybe not.
Actually, no, they didn't have any Blackjack. But they did create VG Mix, which is no longer around, sadly. Well, actually, you know what? I'll get to that because it kind of is. But VG Mix started as a video game music website, video game remix website that was free of the restrictions of a judges panel. So basically, you could kind of submit whatever you wanted and get it posted and hosted, which was kind of a novelty at the time because this wasn't a very common thing. Nowadays, you have sites like SoundCloud and YouTube, places where you can easily host audio real easy, just throw it up there. But back then, bandwidth and network storage, server storage, was not cheap. So it was kind of cool. Most of the music on the original VG Mix was a little rough, not very good, but there were some gems in there. VG Mix has gone up and down a couple times. First time it went down was in 2003, but then it went through a major overhaul and came back in 2004 when it became VG Mix 2.0, and it sort of had a tier system where you could where users could vote on remixes, and the best ones sort of rose to the top tier, and the lower tiers were kind of reserved for the ones that either didn't get much attention or weren't very good.
So we went from no judges to everyone is judges.
Pretty much, yes. Now, while this stuff is going on, there was a very small convention happening in Virginia in September of 2002. It's called the Mid-Atlantic Gaming Festival at this time. The first one had less than 300 people, but now, oh man, MAGFest, it's huge. Last month in February, over 10,000 people, actually no, I'm sorry, 20,000 people. I read that wrong. 20,000 people at MAGFest. And it's just growing bigger and bigger. More bands, more stuff every year. The very first MAGFest, from what I can tell, had three bands. Now they have three bands in the space of an hour at a MAGFest. Three bands playing simultaneously. So
that is insane.
Yeah. The video game music cover band scene kind of arose thanks to MAGFest and thanks to the mini bosses. And is just, yeah, it's insane. When I went to MAGFest 10 back in 2012. There were over 9,000 people there. And to think that it's more than doubled since I've been there is kind of crazy. I would love to go back, but I haven't had the chance to yet. But yeah. MAGFest, definitely something you should check out and an integral part of video game music remixing.
Do they still hold it in Virginia, or do they change venues, or have they got a new venue that they regularly go to now?
It's kind of in Maryland now. It's sort of in the greater Washington, D.C. area. So it moved a bit. It was originally in Roanoke, Virginia, I believe, and then moved up into Maryland in the D.C. area. So it didn't move too far, but they needed a bigger hotel.
You need multiple hotels, good lord.
Yeah, they capped out at like 6,000 people at MAGFest 9, and they're like, yep, we need a bigger hotel. So they moved to a huge hotel. MAGFest is just a lot of fun. Even if you're not there for video game music, there's still a ton of stuff to do. There's a free arcade with a ton of cabinets donated by people to use while you're there. You can buy things in the convention center, and it's just a really awesome gathering of video game fans and video game music fans. So, while MAGFest was growing, and while OCR had continued to grow, and while VG Mix was kind of getting more popular, we had the mini bosses, who I said we'd get back to. The mini bosses had a small community of fans on their own forum, and that the forums kind of exploded after they migrated in 2003 to The Shiz, it's not really anymore, unfortunately, but it was an online collective of musicians who were based in the Phoenix, Arizona area, where the mini bosses are. So the mini bosses sub forum on The Shiz kind of exploded with fans and with people who wanted to create game music arrangements with guitars and other live instruments. So this is where the rise of the rock and metal guitar remix has kind of come from, which are very popular nowadays. There's a little competition that you might have heard of called the Dwelling of Duels.
And there's always good stuff that comes out of that.
Oh, yeah. And this came about because of this forum. I have a story to tell you, Ian. It's kind of funny. In September 2003, I went and looked up the original thread because it still exists. There was a forum member on The Shiz, the mini bosses forums, called Oroku Saki, the Shredder.
I get it.
Yes. He made a thread where he challenged other guitarists on the forum to a shred competition. Basically to shred on guitar. Who's the best shredder? Of course, Oroku Saki's gonna be the best shredder because he's the shredder, right? So this competition happened. It's kind of hilarious. If you read the thread, people are like, shred competition? That sounds so stupid. How could we even judge that? How could we do that?
Well, you just look at how far your socks have been rocked off.
Exactly, yes. So the competition happened. It was a big success. And the Dwelling of Duels was born. And it's going strong ever since. Every month there's a new competition. And the Dwelling of Duels, it's a monthly live instrument game arrangement competition. Basically, you're given a theme, and you have a month to make an arrangement where the lead instrument has to be played live. That's pretty much DOD in a nutshell. So, what made DOD huge? Well, in mid-2004, some of the guys from VG Mix apparently caught wind of DOD, And they moved over to the Shiz and started throwing their hat into the Dwelling of Duels. So that's when we had guys like Aleshon and Vert, who you might know better now as Jake Kaufman. Yes.
Or as the Bad Man.
Yes, that's true too. But yes, Jake got his start doing video game music remixes. For those of you who don't know, the composer of Shovel Knight was originally a video game music remixer in this scene that I'm talking about right now. So, with their involvement though, I think that's what really helped DOD to grow and become a staple of the VG arrangement scene that that we see nowadays. So, it's kind of funny though, because the movement of the VG Mix guys happened right after DOD had Ninja Gaiden Month, which had one single entry. There was one entry in Ninja Gaiden Month, and all of a sudden there was this influx of VG Mix guys who came over there and was like, yep, we'll play. We'll have fun with this. And I was like, wow, that's weird. I don't know if that was just a coincidence or if they just saw there was like one entry and they're like, no, this thing's too cool. We can't let it fall. We gotta get in there. So that's kind of funny to me. Of course, the mini-bosses have carried on. They're still around, and they're still rocking hard. But their popularity kind of led to the inspiration for some of the earlier cover bands, like the Any Eskimos, which is a hilarious band name.
This is one of the best things about these cover bands, is the names they come up with.
Oh yeah, the silliest band names are often the best. So that, along with Magfest, led to the rise of the cover band and live performance explosion that we have today. You can pretty much thank the mini-bosses for live guitar covers on YouTube, in a sense. They may not have been directly inspired by the mini-bosses, but the inspiration kind of leads into each other.
The kind of proof of concept that you can do this and that there is an audience for it.
Right, exactly.
So that one group that may say, do we really want to even invest time with this publicly? Well, the mini-bosses are doing it. Well, yeah, sure. If they can do it, we can do it.
Yep, indeed.
Now, you may not know this off the top of your head, but a couple of bands that I particularly enjoy, wonder when they kind of first showed up on the scene. First up would be the 1UPs.
The 1UPs appeared, actually, I think, as a response to the great remixer Exodus of 2002 from OCR.
There you go.
Mustin was one of the guys who, I think, got banned or left the OCR forums at that time. And he decided to kind of go on his own and create sort of a jazz band and a record label, a net label, that at least tried at the time to get songs officially licensed and sold through game music composers, which wasn't an easy thing to do at the time because most developers and publishers didn't and still really don't have a front-facing person you can talk to about licensing rights.
And especially with music over in the West.
Right.
Or really outside of Japan, I should say.
Right.
The other favorite of mine, before we move on to that, if just as an example, look up the 1UPs Super Mario Sleigh Ride. That is one of the most fun tracks I've ever listened to.
Oh, yeah.
And the other band I was going to ask about is, when did Power Glove first show up on the scene?
Power Glove? I want to say it was like 2006, 2005 for their initial remixes. I remember discovering them on VG Mix, actually. They released a couple of songs there, and they were pretty rockin'. And then I think they went over to the Shiz forums and started posting on there. And then I heard about their releases through there. Their releases originally were free, I want to say, through their website. And then they eventually got signed to, I forget the name of the record label, but it's a pretty major record label. I think they're still with them today, but I haven't heard anything from them in a while, so I'm not sure.
Suggestion for that, go on YouTube, look up Power Glove and Mario Side B. You will be amazed at what they did with the original 1-1 track.
Yeah. Power Glove is really a creative metal band. They're awesome. Their last album was a collection of TV show theme songs, cartoon theme songs, and it's really cool stuff. If you're nerdy like me and Ian, you'll probably get a kick out of it. Their cover of the Pokemon theme song with the lead singer of Sonata Arctica, yeah, that's really good stuff. So going back to OCR, OCR grew in popularity pretty big time. I remember in 2003, I want to say, they had an article. There was an article in EGM, the magazine EGM, Electronic Gaming Monthly, that talked about OCR. And that led a lot of people to discovering the site and discovering video game music arrangements. And that was definitely one of the things that sort of provided a catalyst for getting more people involved. And there were a couple of other magazines as well that sort of featured them. And that just kind of grew from there. In 2003, there was the release of the OCR's first collaborative album, called Relics of the Chozo, remixing Super Metroid. This is a pretty big deal now, because OCR sort of popularized the collaboration album. And there's hundreds of collaboration albums out there now, featuring tons of people. Harmony of Heroes for the Super Smash Bros. Series, which is an absolutely massive album. The recently released Chronicles of Time, which is a Chrono Trigger arrangement album. I've done a few different ones myself. I've led a few of them, directed them, and there's just tons of them out
there.
Name
drop them. Name drop them.
Am I supposed to? Okay, yes. Fine. Summoning of Spirits, Around the World, and Shellshocked are all ones that I directed on OCR. I had help from Aaliyah Baker from Lee on Summoning of Spirits, and my good buddy Wallen helped me out with Around the World, which covers Super Dodgeball. And yeah, it was a lot of fun to put those together, but I think they're just part of a much bigger thing that sort of became massive. The concept of a video game music album, a collaborative album, didn't really exist before Relics of the Chozo. So we definitely have that one to thank for the movement, I suppose.
At the same time, I would imagine it's somewhat of a natural evolution. You have people coming together initially just to prove that you can compose this kind of music, and then you push the boundaries and see how you can change the music in your own style. And then you can come together and show that it can be done with live music and full compositions with a band or an individual. And then once you have the individual songs coming together, it only seems natural that from there these artists come together under the theme of the games, which provide so many tracks themselves, and create an album from there. It's just this beautiful, natural, blossoming, musical adjective thing.
Right, right. Definitely. Now, unfortunately, VG Mix went down in 2007, and it seems to be kind of down for good. Not quite, but I'll get to that in just a second. There is one revival, VGRemix.com, which is the current incarnation, but it was launched a few years ago by a completely new team, headed up by Sergeant Rama, or Reminiscence, from OCR. So, unfortunately, the original VG Mix is kind of gone. VG Remix is up, though, and if you want to go peruse that site, I definitely recommend it. There's some good stuff on there.
Is it an archive of the old site, or is it something brand new?
No, that's a new one. The archive of the old site is actually up as well. That's VGMixArchive.com. So if you want to head on over there and grab those. They aren't in tiered order, though, so you kind of have to dig to find some of the better stuff. And that's kind of where we are today. OCR and DoD still exist, and they're still doing all sorts of cool stuff. I'd say the rise of Bandcamp popularized the album format, and we've seen Bandcamp doing a lot of really cool stuff with not just video game music, but also indie-created music in general. It really made self-distribution online a real attainable thing. So between Bandcamp and SoundCloud and YouTube, I think we're in pretty good hands with the video game music remixes today. So that's kind of where we stand right now. A lot of the stuff, like I mentioned before, has led to a lot of these remixers becoming forces to be reckoned with in the game industry. Like I mentioned before, Jake Kaufman, composer of Shovel Knight, Shantae, Double Dragon Neon, and DuckTales Remastered, among many, many others, basically got his start doing arrangements. Super Meat Boy and Crypt of the NecroDancer by Danny Baranowski. Danny Baranowski himself started as a video game music remixer. One of his more famous songs might be Knuckle Duster from the Sonic 3 and Knuckles OCR album Project Chaos. I think a lot of our listeners would be familiar with that one.
If not, definitely look it up. It's hilarious.
Oh yeah, it's outstanding. Andrew Aversa, or Zircon, he's the one who went on to work on Soul Calibur 4. as one of the composers for that, along with his wife, Jillian Aversa, who did vocals for that one, and also a couple of indie games, including Dungeon Mans. Big Giant Circles himself is doing some indie games for mobile platforms, like Extreme Road Trip, which is a game that I really enjoy, even though it kind of nickel and dimes you if you're not careful. Will Roget, a.k.a. Bustatoons, which is a great name, is one of the composers for Star Wars The Old Republic, or was, actually. Unfortunately, since LucasArts folded, it's kind of, I guess, not abandoned because EA is handling The Old Republic, but anyway. And he also did the music for Lara Croft and The Temple of Osiris, which released, was it last year, a couple years ago? I don't remember exactly.
I think it was a couple years ago.
But basically, a pretty big name game. Tomb Raider, not exactly unknown.
Just a little bit of one of them higher-ranked franchises.
Right. And then one of the coolest things to come out of this whole scene was the soundtrack for Street Fighter II HD Remix, the digital re-release of Street Fighter II, which was all done by remixers from Overclocked Remix. So if you have that game, be sure to go check out the soundtrack to that, because it's really awesome. And it's available from OCR for free as well, so you can pick up the soundtrack there. But I think the game is on 360 and PS3.
So we've got the evolution, as we already covered, going from just proving you could do it to having these whole collaborative albums and shows that number in the tens of thousands of people getting into the industry. Do you have any predictions on where the remixing scene might go from here?
I just hope it grows. That's really what I'm hoping. I think it is. It's still growing. There's still a lot of people, new people getting involved, people who are talking to their friends and being like, hey, have you heard of this site? Have you heard of this? Have you heard this song? And then rethinking, hey, I'm a musician, or hey, I can play some of this stuff. Maybe I can, maybe we can form a band and start our own band. And the cover band scene especially is still growing immensely. Magfest, I know, gets a lot more applications than they're able to support for cover bands. They definitely aren't starving for live performers. So just this huge boom of live performance stuff especially. That's kind of where I see things going, is the live performance aspect continuing on. So we're going to have a lot more metal bands, and jazz bands have definitely become huge. I'm not sure where it came from exactly, but there's like the Super Soul Brothers and Missing No and a few others that are just jazz cover bands. So they have like, you know, saxophone, upright basses, jazz drums. It's a jazz band, and they're covering video game music. It's glorious. So that's kind of where I see it going. The live performance aspect is definitely one that's still growing for sure.
And with all the technology and tools that are becoming more and more available to the upcoming generation, it's just rather exciting to think of what may come next.
Right. That's kind of what led to the growth to begin with, was throughout the 2000s, especially consumer grade and prosumer grade audio equipment has just become extremely cheap. And being able to record professional quality stuff in your own home is super easy these days. Maybe not super easy, but
compared to 20 years ago.
Yeah, exactly. It's definitely changed a lot of things. So that's kind of where I see things going, is equipment becomes cheaper and people hear more and more about these awesome video game music cover bands, and just kind of what's going on with Magfest and OCR and Dwelling of Duels and all that cool stuff. I just see it growing from there. YouTube is it's like its own community now of video game musicians who basically started on YouTube and doing performance videos on YouTube. So I definitely see that growing too. And that's it for video game music remixes. That's where we are right now, and I really hope it continues growing, and I hope people kind of enjoyed this overview, as kind of scattershot as it might have been, of video game music arrangements. It was kind of all over the place, in the 90s especially, but...
Well, that was the 90s in general,
wasn't
it?
Yeah, that's true. But it's really grown into something great and something that I really enjoy, and I hope that... I hope this kind of look at it, this high-level overview of it, was interesting to people.
I don't know, I find it fascinating myself.
Well, that's good.
But some people prefer different kinds of information, and that kind of information comes from the Q&A.
Q&A. Q&A, Q&A. This is my vamping song.
First up, we have our prioritized Q&A coming from our patrons over at patreon.com/bubblecast.
We have a question from The Shadow Imperator. He asks, this is going back quite a bit, but when the preview for issue 223 was released, you said on the Bumble King forums that there was a reason both for Ben Bates to have drawn Nagus bat-like, as another member put it, as well as Hunched and Ugly by Stephen Butler. Later issues established Nagus' ugliness, and changes in appearance were caused by the first Genesis wave, which occurred after these issues. Did you originally intend for Nagus' mutation to be a result from Jeffrey restoring his sanity with the Chaos Emerald, rather than Operation Clean Sweep?
How many years ago was that now? Four?
Yeah. 223, so where are we at now? I don't even know.
The in-canon reason, I guess, was primarily that Nagus was doing better initially, but as he degraded, he got uglier and uglier. The Chaos Emerald was part of that, and consistent use of it was supposed to degrade him further, but then the Genesis Wave caused everything to get even worse, which, you know, exacerbated things. The real world reason is Ben Bates has a much cleaner style and Steve Butler has a much more detailed style, and they just drew him differently.
What a concept.
I mean, there's consistency, and then there's, right, you know, different artists have different takes on things.
Right.
John Gray drew everybody extremely elastic and cartoony, that there isn't an in-universe reason why they were made out of flubber, you know, for four issues. That's just the artistic style.
Yeah, that's just John Gray's thing. He's a cartoonist.
And let's move on to the general Q&A now.
The JC Freak asks, this is a pretty long-winded question. You tend to have a set method of introducing new places to the comic, wherein Sonic and friends show up, they meet the Egg Boss, and or meet a local Freedom Fighter group, team up with the local Freedom Fighters to defeat the Egg Boss, and promise to return someday. The formula does get played with, and sometimes there aren't local Freedom Fighter groups so much as local fighters or people in general. But my question is, any particular reason you favor this setup?
It's pretty much the easiest way to introduce the setting, the characters, and the conflict in a bite-sized format.
Which comics kind of are. There's not much room.
Right. I mean, in a lot of cases, I may not necessarily have the time to delve into the greater conflict like I want to. Or it may be that it's experimental. We don't know if this particular group or character is going to take off. And if we devote too much time and energy into something that just does not resonate with readers, that feels like wasted time. Especially with the Shattered World Crisis story arc that we have going on right now, the idea is more to do the world building quick and dirty and then expand upon it from there. Because the single biggest desire I got from the readers after the reboot, aside from don't reboot, which I can't do,
yeah,
was get back the world building. So that's what I've been focusing on. And no, they are not in-depth stories. They are not very complex, but they're not supposed to be. They are introductions. You get the idea of who these characters are, what they can do, and what the conflict around them is. And from that point, we can go crazy with it. Look at all that we've already established up to this point. We're still going to be establishing things up through the end of the Shadow World arc. And from there, each individual one of those moments could be turned into its own larger story arc. We have these characters to explore. We have these regions to investigate. We have these villains to rise, fall, change, don't change. All of that material is there, and all we had to do were these simple introductory stories. Treat this as kind of the first season, I guess, of a show, mm-hmm. where you're really introducing everything. And now, once that's there, we can move forward and do so much more. But you can't do that until the foundation is laid. So I'm laying the foundation as fast as I can, in the most entertaining way that I can, that doesn't bog it down, and then we can do even more stuff.
Was, are you able to say anything about the slated ending of the Shattered Worlds arc? Like, are we coming up on it pretty soon here? Is it a little ways off still, or how's
that
going?
It's still a few months down the way, but it has been solicited that it will basically be the ending to Sonic Unleashed. It's not going to be the exact same as the game, because we've gone in different directions with the characters and locations.
Right.
But it's going to be a four-part arc that's going to be absolutely insane.
Well, I'm looking forward to it. All right, we got one from Matt SO586 here. They ask, how did Orbot and Cubot get back from space?
I don't know. That wasn't covered in the official canon, and I doubt it ever will be. I like to think that they just kind of tumbled down until they reached the planet, survived through reentry because they're ridiculously hardy little machines.
Yeah.
Hit the ground, dusted themselves off, and said, well, we better get back to the base before the boss does. He'll want his coffee.
That makes sense to me.
And they don't really need anything complex. It's all about
no.
a Cubot.
Yeah,
right. Ready for the joke.
Right, right. Yeah, exactly. All right, let's go on to the next question here from DeLuna13. They want to know if you have seen Ruby, and what do you think of it? It's RWBY, by the way, the Rooster Teeth series.
Oh, that Ruby, that Ruby.
Yeah, sorry, I should have specified.
I've seen a little bit of Season 1.
Same here.
And I really enjoy the soundtrack.
Oh, yeah.
In a kind of guilty pleasure sort of way. The action sequences back when they were done by the late Monty Ohm, who was robbed from us.
Yeah.
Were absolutely spectacular. The show itself didn't really sink its claws into me, but the action sequences are worth a look. The soundtrack is a lot of fun if you want to get it. I think it's up to its third season now.
Yeah, somewhere around there.
So I haven't really followed it, but, you know, in terms of an original animated series, I give the entire crew major kudos for even producing it, you know?
Yeah, definitely.
Not to say that Machinima doesn't require a certain degree of work, but something that's wholly and fully animated originally is such a much larger undertaking. And that they have lasted this long and have such a devoted fan base, I think, is really cool.
Yeah, definitely. I've seen bits and pieces of Season 1, and I really enjoy it. Like you said, the soundtrack's actually really cool. I like it a lot. And the action scenes are astounding. Just fantastic stuff. And I really like the character designs, too. It's just something about the character designs I really like.
They really do pop. They're very strong individuals.
Yeah, and the color palette, I mean, it's obviously named for colors, so it's not really surprising, but the color palette really works. And how each character kind of has its own individualized color scheme. You know, it's a Power Rangers thing. Or Super Sentai thing, I suppose.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Diamond Death asks, I was expecting Ian to say he couldn't talk about which characters he would want to bring back because it would be confirming who is not allowed to come back, as he had stated in a previous podcast. Have those rules changed, or was that a mistake? Like when you talked about Shard and stuff on a previous episode.
No, that's people trying to find anything I say and twist it to whatever they want it to mean.
Right.
They asked, who do I want to bring back? And I answered. That doesn't confirm whether or not they're ever going to come back, because I don't know. I don't have any control over that. They may be gone forever. I may get a call tomorrow and say, oh, hey, look, we're getting everybody back. Do a storyline. I don't know. I don't control that. Please stop asking me. It's been 2 years, and it really, really puts me in a bad situation because of stuff I can't get into, which is frustrating for me and frustrating for everyone else. But I don't know who would ever possibly come back. I know who I would want to come back, but I can't speak to whether or not they ever will because it's completely out of my control.
So stop asking.
They won't, but, you know.
Yeah, it'll never happen. All right, here's a long question from Scruffy. They want to know, what would be the most effective way to ensure that you could come to Oz Comic Con Melbourne so that I may shake your hand, get you to autograph my comics, and get all flustered and lost for words at the prospect of meeting one of my idols? Should I resort to blackmail, kidnapping, unleashing my doomsday device that creates Bumble King-shaped crop circles, an elaborate torture scheme that involves Dubs singing the Sonic Underground soundtrack whilst playing the accordion really, really badly?
Is that the end of list of demands?
That's the end of the questions. Well, I don't know if that's demands so much as he's just wondering if that's what he has to do to get you to come to the show.
Personally, I want to see the device that makes Bumble King-shaped crop circles. I'll fire it myself. Never mind the crops, I'll aim that sucker at the moon.
That sounds awesome. Yeah, put that logo on the moon. Brand that thing.
In terms of getting books signed, since I can't travel a whole lot, and I have readers all over the world, which is kind of mind-boggling. If anyone wants to try to contact me and is willing to foot the shipping and handling both to Canada and back, I will happily sign whatever you mail my way. I've had folks send me their books. I sign them, and I mail them back. But I can't really afford to do the postage for everyone who wants that to happen. So if you are willing to foot that bill, I will be happy to sign it. I won't charge anything for the signing itself, because I refuse to do that. I cannot tolerate the idea of charging people for my name. It doesn't sit well with me.
I'm thankful for that.
And to get a little off topic, I understand why some writers do it, because an artist can do sketches. Mm-hmm. They can do commissions. Writers can't really do that. We really rely, especially comic book writers, we rely a whole lot on the selling power of the artist. That's what catches people's eyes first, not the text.
Right.
So I understand why some writers charge for a signature, because that's really the only thing they can do aside from sell books.
Mm-hmm.
And for some of the really big professionals, it's just to save some time. They will charge upwards of $50 just to get in a line to see them, and that weeds out the crowd. They don't necessarily like it because you have to turn people away who can't afford it, but at the same time, it immediately diminishes the number of people who you want to see you. And while I really love interacting with people at conventions and shows and whatnot, when you do that for multiple hours at a time, nonstop, for 3 days in a row, it's really exhausting. It's a great amount of fun. I wouldn't trade it for anything else in the world. I wish I could do it more, but it's really, really sapping. And I am, like, bottom of the barrel in terms of celebrity status. When you have someone who is, one of the Marvel or DC big names and are beloved by tens of thousands of people, I can't even imagine.
Oh, yeah.
Now, in terms of going to shows, a lot of stuff is well outside of my fiscal ability. I'm able to do Toronto Comic Con this March because I live in Toronto. I'm going to try to do Heroes Con in Charlotte, North Carolina this summer because I have family in Charlotte. I can stay there for free. But beyond that, travel, lodging, it's really something I can't do. So if OzCon, in their madness, would want to foot the bill to fly me in and set me up, sure, I'd love to come to that delightful little continent that's full of nothing but deadly animals. But I don't think they're going to do that, because, like I said, I'm kind of bottom of the barrel in terms of celebrity status. The only time that has ever happened was Summer of Sonic in, 2012
or 13, one of those?
Yeah, something like that.
A couple years ago.
They actually went so far as to do my lodging, do my airfare, and my travel insurance, which was crazy. And I did that show as long as I could. Until the heat and the pressure of the room, because they had no AC, unfortunately, kind of gave me a migraine, and I had to regretfully bow out. But great show, wonderful staff. I'm still super flattered that they went to all that just to fly me out there. But, and I hate to sound like a prima donna. I hate to ask for handouts. It drives me up the wall. So I don't want to ask to be treated like some kind of celebrity, but that's the only way I could really get out to OzCon. Or really any con outside of what I can normally do.
Yeah, outside of where Archie pretty much goes to represent itself.
Now, if there's some ridiculously wealthy philanthropist who just happens to listen to the Bumblecast and wants to fund me writing stuff nonstop, you can contact me at bkc.contact@yahoo.com.
Do that. Somebody. Somebody do the thing. And get Ian to do the things that are the things that he should do eventually. We got to get you to Phoenix Comic Con one of these days. You won't have to worry about a place to stay when you do that one. I will say that.
That is appreciated.
I'll just leave you on the side of the road. It's fine. No, I'm just kidding.
Well, it's Arizona. It'll be warm during the evening, so I'll be fine.
Yeah, I'll be fine. Go Go find a public library during the day. You'll be fine. Or, well, I guess you'll be at the show, so never mind. Okay, we got one last question here from 4SonicFan. This one says, this is a really silly question. I don't know if I can even read it properly. It says, "Hey, Ian, you have very good Big the Cat voice. I was wondering if Smalls the Cat would sound the same. Could you do the two voices?"
Oh, dear. Well, yes, in my mind, the old Antiverse characters all sounded like their counterparts, but with noticeably different inflection. So, you know, Big the Cat, who's so dumb and simple and sweet, sounds like this.
Sounds like Duke Nukem if Duke Nukem were an idiot.
Though, that would be more like Smalls. Smalls the Cat is closer to Duke Nukem. He's here to kick bum and chew bubblegum, and he's all out of bubblegum. Look out, Kyle. Your is grass, and I'm the weed whacker.
I've never even heard that before.
So that would be Smalls.
I've heard your is grass, but I've never heard "and I'm the weed whacker."
I love that. That's poetry. That's brilliant.
That is brilliant. Holy crap. I can't believe I've never heard the second part of that before. Oh, man, that's great. Next, Walt Disney, who has sent in a lot of questions and who just happens to be showing up in more often than not on this show, I think, asks, "Can we please, for the love of Light Gaia, see Cream and Cheese fight someone in the comic and win?"
Sure. And something to keep in mind is Cream is not the same level of active combatant as the rest of the cast. Yes, she's young, like Tails, younger, really.
Yeah.
But Tails also grew up directly under Sonic. Not to say Cream is a pushover. She and Cheese can, you know, hold their own, but they aren't the ones to actively seek battle, and they aren't the ones best equipped for battle. So,
right.
And there are certain limitations that we have to work in because they are, you know, Sega characters. So, you will see Cream and Cheese get into the fray. Just don't expect them to be on top of every single battle like Sonic is. Because that's not who they are.
That would be kind of amazing, though. Maybe you could do like an opposite day story or something. I don't know. That's the stupidest idea I've ever had. That's like Sonic pre-issue 30 level. Maybe that... And just go back to that. I don't know. So that's it for the Q&A.
And that wraps it up for this show. Please feel free to check out our Patreon at patreon.com/bumblecast, where you can see all our incentives and the various ways you can support us so we can continue to entertain you. You can keep up with all the news of what I'm up to at bumbleking.com or on Twitter at IanFlynnBKC. Be sure to come by Toronto Comic Con the weekend of the 19th. Come by and see me and say hi to Aaliyah Baker.
Hi, Aaliyah Baker. Oh, wait, not right now, you mean?
No, at the show, at the show.
Oh, okay. You can follow what I'm doing at kngi.org, and you can also keep up with this show there as well. And you can see what I'm doing on the social medias at KyleJCRB on Twitter.
And as always, we'll wrap up with a big shout-out to all of our patrons who make this show possible. Thank you all so much. Give a quick shout-out to Daniel H., Justin G., the Shadow Imperator, James K., Patty M., Alex P., and Connell T. Thanks again so much for all you've done for us, guys.
You are awesome.
And if you want to get in on asking any questions to me and or Kyle, you can ask them in the comments below, to us on Twitter, #BumbleCast, or if you're a patron, in the Patrons Message Center at patreon.com/BumbleCast.
That's going to do it for this edition of the BumbleCast. Hope you guys enjoyed the show.
We will see you in April.
See you later.
Hi there, and thanks for listening to the Bumblecast. If you liked our show, be sure to hit the subscribe button and consider supporting us on Patreon. We have some great rewards as well as big plans on how to make the show even better. Also, rate and review our show on iTunes. It gets more folks listening and helps us out, so we definitely appreciate it. Original music composed by Ken Coda Snyder, used with permission. Find more of his music at bc.s3m.us and find the theme song at noisechanradio.bandcamp.com, available as a pay-what-you-want download.